The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums. This is Digital Campus number 29 for the 3rd of July, 2008. Making it count. I'm Dan Cohen. And it's time once again for another edition of the virtual roundtable here at Digital Campus headquarters at the Center for History and New Media. At George Mason, I'm here with Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Pretty good. Hope everyone's enjoying their summer and have good 4th of July plans. Have you guys picked up Firefox 3 yet? I'm actually looking at it right now. It's looking terrific, nice and fast.
Yeah, I've been using it since since before the first release candidate, maybe since the beta 4. Yeah, it's great. It's fast. It's slick. I think the UI is a lot better. I think if people are still using Firefox 2, they'll be pleased. And I think, you know, I'd recommend people go and it's a quick download and easy install. Keep all your bookmarks and all. So I definitely recommend it to listeners.
Yeah, I've been very impressed, in particular with the speed increase.
Yeah, I think it's going to make it a little bit easier for us to evangelize Firefox in the educational community. I mean, I thought 2 was pretty slow, and it was a little bit buggy, and this feels really snappy, and so I think it's a lot easier. And I think also now that we're a few years on, people, I think, are feeling more comfortable about moving over to Firefox. Actually, worldwide, it's up to 18%. And I think IE is down to somewhere in the mid-70s, which is, you know, IE used to be 95% of the market. So this is a pretty incredible move. And certainly we've noticed, I think, at the center that some of our sites have over 50% Firefox usage. So it's really not a marginal alternative browser. It's now really sort of number two. It's quickly becoming the Pepsi to Coke. And actually that's probably an apt description. Anyway, I suppose there's not a lot with Firefox 3 that relates to education, but good to just mention at the top of the podcast. Maybe a bonus featured software download for the week when we get to our links at the end of the show. But first, as usual, let's start with the news roundup. Well, I guess you know, one story that really caught our eye this over the past couple of weeks was Amazon's Kindle, which we've talked about before. In fact, we did a whole featured story on ebooks and their potential. Well, certainly it looks like university presses have decided there is a lot of potential there, and they're starting to, in fact, release books. Princeton University Press, Yale University Press, Oxford are all moving very aggressively, actually, onto the Kindle. Is this going to make any difference in terms of, you know, we always talk about the university presses being in a certain kind of crisis, and I guess by that we mean a kind of financial crisis. Will this help them out to not have to print stuff out on paper and to not have to do these kind of limited runs of paper books that might sit in a warehouse for years?
Here's where I think it's going to make the biggest difference is with the kind of marginal sales books, the things which are being sold regularly and it makes sense for them to continue to print copies of, then I think they'll keep doing that. But I think for the book that sells pretty well the first year and not so well the second year and then kind of drops down to the 50 or 60 professors who assign it on an annual basis, that where they're going to make extra money is they're going to be able to continue to sell those books over and over and over, but only in this electronic format.
Yeah, it doesn't look, though, Mills, like they're going for the long tail here, at least initially. I mean, Princeton University Press, not exactly taking a gamble by having a book by Robert Schiller, you know, who was the famous irrational exuberance economist and generally depressive figure in the economic field. He's got something on the subprime crisis coming out. It's called Subprime Solution, How Today's Global Financial Crisis Happened and What to Do About It. This seems like a popular press putting out a book on the Kindle.
Yeah, they're definitely going with the safe route for now. Although, I mean, I was surprised, as you said, Dan, how aggressive they really are with this. They're putting out, it's not just a couple of titles. It's a bunch of titles. But as you say, they are the more mainstream titles and the more famous, more sort of safe authors. But eventually, I think they probably will move to the long tail. In some respects, though, I think this is – I still have skepticism about the Kindle and all of these ebook readers. Or maybe it's not skepticism, but I think that, like, what's the real story here? I mean, this seems like a more of an evolution of the traditional text, an evolution of the traditional book than a fundamental technological shift to me, or something that's going to be really change the nature of scholarship and publishing. And I see it more as just another distribution channel, just like Amazon is another distribution channel. But I do think, as Mills said, the long tail is really the hope for this model.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any big value added to this other than the long tail and then, you know, possible convenience. You know, we talked a lot about Kindle before and I'm still pretty skeptical about its value for education other than just continuing to make out of print books available in an electronic format.
You know, there was a big meeting of not the university publishers, but the total book world a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, the reporting on that in the New York Times and other places seem to say that a lot of publishers are worried about the Kindle, that it might destroy their business model. But I think for university presses, and I think in part, you know, they're selling the books themselves pretty cheaply. Like a lot of books are $9.95 on the Kindle. And of course, Amazon's getting a big cut of that, although they work out deals. I think for a university press, Mills, although I disagreed with you, just at least in terms of this initial release, they seem to be going for the greatest hits. But you know, you could imagine some books that are really in the long tail that, you know, maybe someone might want to sample, you know, a Kindle owner might want to sample for $9.95, pick up a book on, you know, a more esoteric topic because they're not paying, you know, I think about those Cambridge University Press monographs that are $100. You know, what about their back run that, farther down the list where a book, you know, they might sell more than 10 copies of a book at $10 versus one at $100. So the pricing models, I think, are pretty interesting in this medium. It looks like, at least at first, they're going for more expensive pricing than the mainstream presses. They're going for $20, $25 ebooks, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think they'll get pounded down on that in a hurry. And I think the people who are really in danger on this are not the presses, but the university bookstores, because it really will cut them out of their most lucrative business transaction, which is the used book. They make way more money on used books than they do on new books, and this will essentially eliminate that market.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Well, speaking of books, another story that caught our eye over the last couple of weeks that we wanted to mention was a pretty interesting collaboration between the Copyright Office, Project Gutenberg, Carnegie Mellon, and the distributed proofreaders, and at the very end, one very enterprising Google engineer, and who have made something that I think is pretty important for our digital academic future available online, and that is a XML file, basically a text file, of the copyright records for books from 1923 to 1963. So this period, for those of you who aren't very familiar with U.S. copyright law, books published between 1923, books published before 1923, are all in the public domain. But between 1923 and 1963 is this kind of gray area before copyright law became much more advantageous to the author, where you didn't, you know, after the 1970s, you didn't have to reassert your copyright on a book to have it automatically renewed. The copyright terms were extended. And so now we're living in a world where if you publish a book, you know, you have the copyright for a long, long time. But between 1923 and 1963, the rights owner had to actually submit a form to the U.S. Copyright Office saying that they wanted to renew their copyright for another 28 years after the first 28 years. And in a lot of cases, actually, in most of the cases, books weren't renewed. And so those books are in the public domain. And really what this means for us in the digital world is those books can be put online and made full text available for free. And so it's, I think, really critical to kind of look at this gray period. But the problem was that we didn't really have good records, and they certainly weren't online. So what happened in this story was that Carnegie Mellon University scanned the Copyright Office records from this period as part of their Universal Library Project, which is online. And then people from Project Gutenberg, which of course has been making free text available for decades, and the distributed proofreaders who often do OCR correction for Project Gutenberg got involved and did all the correction, amazingly, on these scans from Carnegie Mellon of the Copyright Office records. And then, finally, someone from Google took those records and did a little processing on them to make them available, massage them into a single XML file, which is now available for download. We'll actually link to this from digitalcampus.tv, but it's on the Google site. And you can just download it. It's a zip file. And get this file, and you can then learn, you know, what books are in the public domain. And those books, you can do whatever you want with them. Is this going to have some kind of impact in terms of scholarship? Is this the first of many projects to sort of figure out what's in the public domain and what's not, and sort of make this online landscape a little bit less tricky in terms of copyright?
Well, in some ways, I think this is kind of unique in that that period from 1923 to 1963 is really kind of the, at least as far as I understand U.S. copyright law, kind of the grayest of the gray periods. But I do think there's some grayness in the copyright laws of I think it's 1976, and certainly with the DMCA. So I think there is opportunity to do this. What I'd really like to see is, one thing I don't know much about are international copyright laws, and I imagine there are, you know, every country has its own copyright law, or most do, and projects, some kind of a aggregation or a unified database where you can go to find this information for copyrights of all countries would be tremendously useful for, I know in our content-focused projects, our education and our public projects, we're always looking for good copyright-free public domain content, and having somewhere that's open and free and comprehensive would be a tremendous benefit.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a one-off in the sense that, so there's this big list of material out there that's copyright free, but then I don't think there are other big lists like this available. I think what would be more interesting, and again, this goes back to our conversation about the Kindle and sort of the long tail of scholarship, is that there are an awful lot of books which have gone out of copyright or gone out of publication where the authors sort of wish that their books would reappear or would be available through some sort of long tail process and not even necessarily for sale, just available for use. And so, you know, authors can reclaim the copyright of those out of print books without much difficulty at all. And so what I'd love to see is a project where that encouraged authors to reclaim their copyright on their out of print books and then make them available easily for scanning in this way. And so then we can have access to that work again.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, you know, in general, I guess a lot of these sort of like, you know, orphan works or these works that are just sort of forgotten, to get more of that stuff. And after all, I mean, what's the overall percentage of books, let's say, from the last 100 years that are still viable, commercially? It's got to be minute. I mean, it's got to be 1% or less. So, you know, you would think that most of this stuff, if you could clear all the rights on it, which is an enormous project, we'd have a much richer commons online to draw from. And I think, you know, and then all the services on top of that. I mean, not just to be able to read it, but be able to search the full text, you know, to be able to mash it up with other other documents. I mean, all of that stuff that we're doing in a kind of Web 2.0 world is just impossible if you don't have the correct rights clearances. We probably should note that the U.S. Copyright Office does make records, copyright records for books from 1978 onward available online. And again, we'll link to that in our show notes. It's copyright.gov/records. But, you know, it's not the same thing. It's not a database. Well, it's a database behind the scenes, but you can search a specific title. But what, I think what's neat about this is, for instance, libraries could download this XML file and integrate it into their online catalogs and then make full text available at a single click. You know, once a scan is available, let's say at Google or at Open Content Alliance, even better, something that's truly open, then they would know, hey, we can link from our online catalog to the full text of that book because that book is scannable, it's been scanned by someone, and we can freely distribute it. So I think that's a pretty powerful combination to be able to do these searches and then be able to link to the full text. Well, you know, we'll see if this is just a one-off thing or more will come online. And I think it'll be interesting to report back maybe in a few months and see if some libraries take this XML file and do something with it. It's an interesting collaboration also between a number of different groups that sometimes are at odds with each other, people like Project Gutenberg and Google. So I guess it's good to see this kind of collaboration. One topic that we haven't really discussed at length here on the podcast that we thought would be a good summer topic and also has been something that's been, I think, blogged a lot recently by a couple of us on the panel, but and that topic is really about making digital scholarship count. And indeed, Mills, that was the title of your three-part series that's been getting a lot of notice. Basically, I want you to describe what you talked about in this series, but I think we've been thinking a lot not only about digital scholarship, but, you know, how it fits into academia, how it fits into promotion and tenure, how it fits into hiring decisions. And I guess this would even go beyond academia, because surely people, for instance, in the museum world who publish, you know, want works that they publish in a kind of digital form or websites that they produce, in some sense count for things like raises and things to put on their resumes and CVs. So maybe do you want to describe a little bit, Mills, you know, what got you thinking about this, why you did this series of posts, and what you learned in writing it?
Well, what really got me to write the series is a conversation that took place at our That Camp program that we talked about in the last episode of Digital Campus. And a number of people toward the end of one of our sessions said, well, you know, it's great we're doing all of this, but, you know, in my department it doesn't actually count. And I realized I had this strong sense of frustration at that. And I was trying to figure out why I was having such a strong reaction. And I realized it was because I've been listening to this conversation now for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And I guess I just kind of gotten tired of listening to the lament of, yeah, but it doesn't actually count.
Right. And we should say we've heard this lament not only at that camp, but, gosh, it must be dozens of conferences that I've been to. It's the first question that comes up, isn't it, of, well, but will it count for tenure and promotion?
Right. And it's just over and over and over. I mean, I can remember, you know, my first foray into something that might be called digital work, was back in 1999. And when I was a fellow with the Carnegie Foundation and, you know, my department chair pulled me into his office one day and said, well, geez, Mills, you know, this stuff that you're doing with this web work, you know, it's really interesting, but, how's your book coming? And because he really didn't care about it.
Right,
and,
right.
And all he cared about was the book. You know, have to put the book on the table, you'll get tenure. And so, you know, and there was also an implied warning there from, you know, to junior assistant professor from the senior department chair that you better get going on that book. And you know, we've all heard various horror stories. I think some of them are probably urban legends. Some of them aren't, about people who've, you know, done really interesting things online and then been denied tenure. But I couldn't take it anymore. And so I decided I would write a series of posts in which I speculated a little bit about this business of counting and what it meant for historians doing digital work. And I tried to be a little more deliberative or thoughtful maybe than I have in some of my other posts, in the sense that I actually wanted to talk to some other people, senior people in our field, to find out what they thought also. And so it wasn't just going to be my reflections on it, but also what some, you know, people who I really respect and who've been around even longer than I have and, you know, seen various iterations of the tenure and promotion mill. And so I talked to Stan Katz up at Princeton and Kathy Davidson down at Haystack, and then Peter Stearns, our provost here at George Mason, who's a past vice president of the American Historical Association. And well, I don't know, as of last week, he was the author of 102 books. I think probably by next week it'll be 103. But we all joke because Peter seems to publish a book a month, but or more. But so, you know, as a provost, he, of course, knows a lot about this business of counting and tenure and promotion. So I tried to figure out, you know, why was it that we're having this problem with digital scholarship counting? And I think what I concluded and I don't know that I even made it as clear as I might have in my blog post, is that we're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole or vice versa, in the sense that we're trying to claim Often we're trying to claim that something that I call digital work as opposed to digital scholarship, we're trying to claim it as scholarship when it isn't. And because it's an incredible amount of work and it has a big audience and it, you know, and it's so, and we're really proud of it. But it's not the same thing as scholarship. And so my argument in this series of posts is that for digital work to count as digital scholarship, it has to be scholarship. And scholarship, I think, is pretty easily defined in any discipline you care to name as the product of research, that it's embedded in a conversation among scholars, it's peer-reviewed, and it's made public. And as you know, as long as it has those main characteristics, and it has some kind of an argument, so as long as it has those five characteristics, then it would fit as scholarship, whether it's in mathematics or history or physics or English literature, or whatever you want to pick, scholarship has those kinds of characteristics. And so often digital projects don't have an argument, or they're not clearly connected to some sort of larger conversation among scholars. You know, they're fabulous projects, but they're not exactly the same thing as scholarship. So I was trying to, and because they're not the same thing as scholarship, then it makes it really hard to make the case that they ought to count. Because, okay, they were an incredible amount of work and they're very popular, but they're not in some way roughly equivalent to a book or a series of articles in prestigious journals or whatever might be your accounting system. So, so that's what I was trying to deal with, and that's really what I heard from all the people that I talked to, was that if we're going to claim it as scholarship, it has to actually be scholarship, not just a big database that with lots of primary sources that people use a lot. And so, for instance, you know, many of our projects here at CH&M qualify in that second category. They're big archives, like the September 11th Digital Archive is a digital project, but I'm not sure why it's scholarship.
I tend to agree with that, and I think I come at it from a slightly different perspective. That, you know, I don't think something like the September 11th Digital Archive, which you know, we all three of us had a big part in, should count as scholarship. At the same time, I don't think that means that it shouldn't count at all for something. And clearly it does count for something to a lot of people. And I guess what I would say is that if scholars and other people working at universities and libraries and museums are making an argument that the nature of scholarly and academic work has changed with digital technologies, I think that they have to be willing to accept that the models and terms of academic employment may also change with that. So, for instance, I'm not in a tenure-track position, and that has its drawbacks, but it also has its benefits. And in fact, I don't care that I'm not in a tenure track position, because it allows me to do all of the kinds of things that I really want to do. I can do the digital projects rather than the digital scholarship, which are my primary interests. So I can work on something like 9/11 or the Hurricane Digital Memory Bank or I can build Omeka, a software a platform, all of these other things which wouldn't count as historical scholarship, although they relate to history and they are historical work in some sense or another, they don't need for me to count. Like I am not judged on whether those things are scholarship by the criteria that Mills just laid out, and that's great for me. It has its drawbacks, like I can be fired, but So can my wife, who's a lawyer. So can 99.5 probably percent of the U.S. workforce. If you don't perform, you may get fired. If you do perform, you generally are rewarded and promoted and compensated. And that's sort of the position I'm in. So I think that in some ways, scholars and academics and librarians and museum professionals and others who want to do this kind of work have to be willing to deal with the consequences. And those consequences, one of those consequences may be that they don't have the same exact terms of employment of as their colleagues doing more traditional work. And that can be fine, as in my case it is. I've been able to kind of find a third path. I'm lucky in that respect. I don't think everyone else has the benefit of being at a place like CH&M or George Mason, but I think that's also part of it. We need to have a shift in that there are other models of employment other than the traditional promotion and tenure system of academic scholarly departments that, you know, that's existed over the past, let's say, 100 years.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I mean, tenure really is a racket, and it's unusual in its compared to other jobs and job security. And, you know, I think we should both, you know, I think academia often doesn't think too much about how unique it is and that there might be other models. So Mills, you know, in reading your series, I had kind of two reactions. I think in some sense, I mean, I very much agree with a lot of what you said. And I think what you wrote in terms of, you know, it's got to look like scholarship, it's got to be part of, you know, make reference to existing discussions, etc. I think that fits very well with my feeling that, for instance, blogs could be scholarship. Often they're not, but they could be scholarship, that there's nothing necessarily preventing them from being sites where scholars post long-form argument. I guess where I diverge slightly from what you've said is that it does seem to me to privilege a bit the standard narrative format that historians are used to. And so then we get to the question of these other forms. So, you know, when you were talking about making an argument, we've tended to make that in a linear text fashion. And so I think the really tricky part for making things count are these kind of sites. Now, 9/11 is just a pure archive that we host. But there are sites that kind of do make some argument, but it's not maybe as clear as a straight narrative text that you'd see in a journal article, which, after all, could be posted on a blog very easily. And then there are kind of digital tools and some of the things that I've worked on that implicitly make an argument about, let's say, the nature of historiography or research, but that isn't clear from the tool itself. So I'll give you, I think, one pretty clear example. So I wrote a tool that's still used pretty widely, the Syllabus Finder, that is just a search engine for syllabi. And you think, well, this is not something that should count. But what I've tried to do with that tool is then to produce scholarship based on it to show people how the tool enables new kind of scholarship. So the tool itself, yes, you know, it's a technical exercise. But there's some intellectual thought that went into sort of the creation of it and then to figure out what the products of it could be. So, for instance, beyond just, you know, trying to find a particular syllabus or a set of syllabi on a particular topic, I ended up writing an article for the Journal of American History using the Syllabus Finder to show how American history was taught at the basic level, at the textbook, you know, History 101 level, and that the Syllabus Finder helped me to produce scholarly insights about the nature of that teaching, for instance, the very strong reliance on textbooks, the very strong reliance on multiple choice examinations. And so in that way, the tool was a kind of bridge that got me to scholarship that would not have been possible without the tool. So in that case, you know, and I've talked about this with a lot of people, or some of the software projects that we have at the center, that I try to tell scholars who are in the tenure track, look, if you're going to build a digital tool or resource, I would really try, I think at least in this transitionary period, if you want it to count, to try to write some piece of scholarship based upon that tool or research that looks more like standard narrative, that then shows how, hey, this isn't just an exercise in HTML and the technical infrastructure, but that it enables something new that we couldn't have done without it. And in that way, I think then you can have recognition for the peer review article based on the resource and the resource itself. that's online, that it then becomes more accessible as a piece of scholarship to people who don't maybe understand the intellectual work that goes into a technical resource. Does that make sense, Mills?
Yeah, and I think I completely agree with that. And what I would say is that a couple things. First of all, on the example of the Syllabus Finder, you know, I think where trying to make it then into a square peg that'll fit into a square hole, the system that we're used to me, that's sort of like the historian, or an equivalent to the historian who comes up with a new methodology for analyzing and presenting an argument about, you know, the past. So, for instance, you know, Pierre Nora wrote this. I can't even think of the name of the book or the article now, that, you know, sort of the first point of thinking about sites of memory, and he uses this term, sites of memory, and then this whole sites of memory industry appears in the historical profession. There are books in every national context and articles and conferences and all this sort of stuff. Well, but everybody has to footnote Nora because he's the one who got it started. And so, you know, he gets more credit because it was his idea to start talking about sites of memory. Or, you know, who was it, the first person to start talking about the public sphere? So when the historian comes up with a new methodology that then creates a cottage industry following it, well, that's you get more credit for that because now you've done something really new and different. Well, that's where the tool fits in, is it's like a new methodology. It allows us to think about the past in ways that we hadn't thought about it before. Or it allows us to understand it in ways that we hadn't understood it before. So the digital tool is sort of like coming up with that new methodological approach. And I think the big difference is digital tools, it's easier to come up with digital tools that allow us to do lots of really interesting things because the possibilities are still so wide open. But I think, so that's where I think that fits. In terms of the linear, nonlinear question, I think you're absolutely right. And I think we're just in a period of transition on that because historians are, as I wrote in an earlier post, you know, we're pretty fussy and conservative when it comes to, as a tribe, when it comes to what we accept and what we don't accept as scholarship. And what we're used to is linear, and nonlinear is hard to figure out. And that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be accepted as scholarship. It just means it takes more explaining to a tenure and promotion committee, or just simply a hiring review committee in a non-tenure situation, like Tom described. And so you have to be able to explain it a little better as to why this is also scholarship. And so, for instance, my next project, I'm calling it a project rather than a book because I don't expect it to ever appear as a book. Instead, I expect it to appear as some kind of a digital project that has many of the same characteristics as a book, but will be a web-based thing. I don't even know what it's going to look like yet, but which has primary sources and an argument and, you know, is the product of conversations among scholars, and it's all of those things, but it's also an opportunity for you as the user to wander around and maybe decide that your argument is actually better or more interesting than mine, but I'm going to have an argument there that is at least made front and center at the beginning of the project.
I guess the only other thing I'd add here is that in some ways we're talking about fitting our digital work into models that already exist for historical or humanities professionals. And I think that's an important thing that we need to do. And we need to take that step and make that effort to make our work understandable to colleagues, our peers, in various ways. I think the only thing I'd say is I think they also need to, in some respects, meet us halfway.
Yeah,
I think it's very important for us to meet them halfway, but they need to meet us halfway too. And I think there are models for that. For instance, I think, Dan, you can do what you did with Syllabus Finder or HBOT or these other tools you built and write a kind of long form narrative piece about historiography and the nature of history teaching and learning and that kind of thing that would be very recognizable to any historian. I also think there are other ways to models from the sciences and from especially the applied sciences for writing up the results of technical research. for a tool. Like, I can imagine a set of articles coming out of Zotero that really just report the results of the research, that explain how you built something, and then to suggest some future directions for research that would be not, let's say, 20-page articles, but would be 4 or 5-page articles that would look more like something that is in an engineering journal or an applied sciences journal. And in those disciplines, those shorter research reporting kinds of articles count. They count for traditional tenure and promotion. And I think that our colleagues, our more traditional colleagues, could look to the way the sciences traditionally do things and find some way to meet us halfway, to not try to fashion some narrative journal article out of what really is technical work, and rather just treat technical work as technical work with its own value. But that also has its needs to be peer reviewed and needs to be reported and needs to be written up in a way that's standard and understandable and reviewable, etc. So I think there's a balance here, and I think that's the balance I think we need to find. We need to do some work, and our colleagues need to do some work to find out where this stuff fits.
And I would add, you know, I said that we're a fussy and conservative tribe, but I would also say that all across the United States anyway, and also in the UK, and these are the only two contexts I'm really familiar with, there is an increasing willingness to start moving toward that halfway position in a lot of different departments. And so it's not as though historians are all this way, but as a group, we as historians have a ways to go to sort of find an acceptance for other forms of scholarship. And I think, and my last post in the series was about the process of peer review, and that's where we differ from other disciplines the most, is that we insist on this prior peer review process as the coin of the realm, and we're one of the only disciplines. There are a few others, but we're one of the only disciplines that insists on that. When I was talking to Stan Katz, he said he was trying to have a conversation with the chairman of the computer science department at Princeton about peer review, and he said they couldn't actually find a way to talk to each other because their systems are so different that nothing that Stan said made any sense to this computer scientist and vice versa. And so, and yet, you know, computer science at Princeton, I'm guessing, is probably a pretty highly developed discipline and department. And so, you know, with really high standards. And so it's just that their method for evaluating is different from ours. And so I don't know that ours is perfect in any way. And so I think we need to, and digital work, as I wrote in this last post, is really undermining that prior peer review process. And that's where I think we're going to have the biggest challenge as a discipline, is to find ways to accept other models of peer review.
Well, we don't get credit for this every week, but we love giving away our software picks, our links, and other things we found online. Tom, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I've got something a little different this week. It's the Creative Commons Case Studies Wiki. For people who don't know, Creative Commons, I'm sure most people do, Creative Commons is a set of open licenses for web and other content that you can create. So if you want to license your blog under an open license that allows people to use and reuse the content on your blog, you can release it under a Creative Commons copyright license. And this is a big trend in the world of the web and also in the world of the scholarly web. And sometimes it's a little confusing there's a variety of licenses you can choose from, each with their own terms. Sometimes it can be a little confusing which licenses to choose. Whether or not you want to release something under an open license is the decision that I think people find hard to make. And the Creative Commons Case Studies Wiki, it's basically a database of case studies of people who have used Creative Commons on their projects. That can help you make this decision. So basically, this is a place where people who have used Creative Commons and released things under Creative Commons licenses have gone and just basically told their stories about how they made the decision, why they chose a given license, why it works or doesn't work for their particular project. And so you can go there and read through these case studies and find a project that looks a little like yours and see maybe learn from the experience of somebody who's already been through this decision-making process. I think it's a really great resource for people who are interested in open access and interested in making their content available under open access terms. So the URL is wiki.creativecommons.org/case-studies. We'll put that in the show notes, and it's a great resource.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Mills, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I've got a new online journal. It's called the Journal on Computing and Cultural Heritage, and it comes from the web portal for the Association of Computing Machinery, which is not the place that I think most historians go looking for a journal. But the first issue came out in June, and it's an international journal, and there's some really, really interesting articles in here that are a little tech heavier than maybe would be normal for a cultural heritage journal, but that's as it should be for this platform. So it's everything from sample 3D models for cultural heritage applications, the dream of a global knowledge network, preservation, emulation, migration, and virtualization of live electronics for the performing arts. It's kind of all across the waterfront for cultural heritage and the intersection with computing. So it's the articles are really well written. It's clearly very carefully edited, and so I highly recommend it.
Great. Thanks very much. Well, in the spirit of Firefox and Firefox 3 releases, I wanted to point to a article on the Mozilla zine. So Mozilla is the company that produces Firefox. And Mozilla zine is actually, I think, a non-affiliated magazine, a sort of online set of articles about Firefox and Thunderbird and other Mozilla creations. And I wanted to point to, in particular, an article about something called about:config. And one of the neat things about Firefox is that you can really trick it out with extensions, you can skin it with different looks, and you can also modify how it works very specifically through a configuration file. And in Firefox 3, if you type into your location bar about:config, you'll get a list of all of those tweaks that you can make. And this article will help you make tweaks to Firefox 3 that I think make it even more useful. So some of the things that, for instance, this points out is that you can have a setting for automatically ending a certain top-level domain extension. So if you type in, let's say you do a lot of things in the .edu domain, and you want it to automatically add .edu every time you type in, let's say, GMU, it will add .edu rather than .com. You can change that in the configuration file. Or this is particularly handy for non-US based users of Firefox, because, for instance, if you're in France, you can have it automatically default to .fr rather than .com. There are other tweaks like turning on spell checking for different size text boxes. So one of the great things about Firefox is, and one of the advantages it has over Internet Explorer, is that it does a spell check when you start typing in large text boxes. But you can go into about:config and change that. So, for instance, it will correct your spelling even in the smallest of text boxes. So if you're typing in something in a one-line search box, for instance, on a website, it will correct your spelling there as well. So there are all these little tweaks, and you can really get into it at Mozilla Zine, and I'll add a link to that from our show notes at digitalcampus.tv. Well, thanks once again, Tom Mills. It was a great discussion about tenure and promotion and digital scholarship, and I hope you both have a good 4th of July, and our audience does as well, and we'll hopefully hear from you online. Again, if you go to digitalcampus.tv, you'll see lots of ways to send us feedback. You can post a response to this episode. You can email us, and you can also give us a call at our new number where you'll leave a voicemail for us. Thanks once again, and we'll see you in 2 weeks on another episode of Digital Campus. We have to fear is fear itself, fear itself, fear itself. Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music. Ask not what your
country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.